Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, Game Wisdom site designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our special guest this week from Zacharu Entertainment, Corvus Elrod.
Hello, hello.
Corvus and I actually go back a little bit. I remember meeting him in Philly. I think it was like 2006, 2007. And he was the man who got me into blogging in the first place. I remember a presentation you gave, I think at one of the IGDA meetings, saying that blogging and writing was a good way of just making yourself, I guess, giving yourself a presence online.
Yes. Also a good way to better understand your craft. I still advocate maintaining a blog, because the public exposure while writing really changes the way you think about and talk about whatever it is you're passionate about, and in a way that is generally beneficial.
Yeah, and I've definitely gotten a lot better, not just at writing, but just in terms of speaking and talking to people about game design, just having regular conversations, thanks to this blog, and thanks to just being more open than I was back in the early thousands.
Yeah, I think it's really important, too, in terms of, or at least where bloggers starting out, is consistency. As long as they can, you know, release something at a frequent rate, you'll always find an audience of some kind. And I think that's really good to build off if you're trying to make a presence online.
The challenge, I think, now is that everyone is pretty much doing it, so you have to figure out some way to get your voice above the crowd.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of that, you do that in many different ways, but most of it's, like, providing some sort of thing for a niche, you know? And for yours, your case would be game design.
And I know, Corvus, you've been doing writing on your own site, Zacharu.com. Are you still keeping up with that site?
I don't post there very frequently anymore, no. Having left the video game industry at the beginning of this year and deciding that I'm not going to make a big, strong push to go into the board game industry, the sense of it being imperative that I maintain a very vocal online presence has changed. I've actually dramatically scaled back my interactions with all of my social networks to focus more on my career conversion. However, that's probably going to change a little bit in the new year. I've got a project I'm chewing around the edges of, trying to decide how I want to approach it. That's probably going to involve a lot of very regular public writing.
Okay, cool. And start with then just like a basic introduction of yourself. Obviously, we know of the Kickstarter project you did in 2011, but for people who aren't too familiar, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So one of my sort of pipe dreams when being involved with the video game industry was to create a role-playing game that actually focused on playing roles rather than just having a combat system around which a linear fiction was attached, which is so true of the vast majority of RPGs today, even if they have a lot of nice distracting dialogue. It's very much following someone else's idea of what the story was, and I wanted to create something a little different. And as anyone who knows me knows, I really believe in paper prototyping video game systems and believe that any truly compelling video game system can also be used to drive a compelling board game or card game. And so in the process of doing a lot of writing about the design of this hypothetical video game, I ended up creating what I feel is a very compelling tabletop storytelling platform called Baloy Dam. And it really recreates that sort of tabletop RPG experience that I've been after for 20 years. My tagline, my description of it, my one liner is that it's a tabletop storytelling platform inspired in equal parts by Russian formalism, semiotics, and commedia dell'arte. So it's very much focused on the performance of stories, you know, the telling of stories rather than upholding a fictional reality. It also relies on highly visual and colorful game boards and tokens to represent your interactions with the story, rather than character sheets with lots of percentages. And
it's also available online, right? Because I remember we did a Google Hangout test, I think like a year or so ago, using the Baloy Dam system.
Right, so I actually just set up some Google Docs and have artwork representing the tokens and the boards in a Google Doc. I have on GitHub, there's a JavaScript file that actually outlines all of the interactions of a board, but I've not gone to the next step of creating a visual interface for it. That will happen at some point. I just have so many projects in the air in any given day that things often fall by the wayside.
Now, you've talked about wanting to do something like Berlin for a while now. Once you start like saying to yourself that I want to make this, how long did it take you to basically get the concept and get things developed on your end?
I've measured the history of Balladim from various places. It either dates back to 1989, which is a little extreme, or it dates back to about early 2009, probably. The first time my gaming group came over, and instead of character sheets on the table, I had folded hexagonal origami paper cups. And in them, I had placed pente beads and go stones and said, we're trying something a little different today. And from that point, moving go stones between cups, from that point until I launched the Kickstarter was about 3 years.
Okay. Now, before the cast, we talked about how you've already ran several pieces about your findings on Kickstarter and what you did on that, so we're not going to dwell too much time on that. For the people listening who want to know more about your thoughts, I'll have links to those posts in the podcast notes below.
And just to give people an idea, one of them is a sort of philosophy so that every Kickstarter you run will be successful, even if you don't actually get all of the money you were asking for. One of them is a suggestion for some rewards tier structures that I learned the hard way and didn't do correctly in my Kickstarter. And the third one is a breakdown of all of the financials of what happened with all of the money that we brought in for our Kickstarter.
And that's definitely interesting, because with a lot of the Kickstarters, especially after last year where it just really blew up as a viable platform, there's still a lot of the post-Kickstarter experience that is still up in the air at the moment.
Right.
I know with Double Fine, they've announced that even though they went above and beyond for Broken Age, they still basically ran out of budget.
Yep.
And then we got guys like Planetary Annihilation, who said they were pushing for a December release, but about a week ago, they announced saying that because of the state of the game, they're just going to push it to when it's done.
Right.
So we still haven't really seen too many of the mega success Kickstarters actually deliver or come out yet. The only one that I can think of just off the top of my head would be Shadowrun Returns, and I think that got like average or above average scores from everyone.
Right. Yeah, I'm really a huge fan of the platform as a consumer, but I'm also very wary, and I also have very realistic expectations. If I back something, it's because I want to help someone work towards making it with no real expectation that they're necessarily going to succeed. So, for example, I didn't back Neil Stephenson's Clang because I know what an enormous challenge he was setting for himself, and I didn't actually feel he'd make anything intelligible or enjoyable that would improve anyone's understanding of how combat works in games. And so I really didn't feel that it was worth spending any money on. And he's now come out and said, well, so we spent all the money and we don't have anything we can even show you. So we're going to look for some more money. And that's like, there's no problem with that. It just bears out that my skepticism of that particular project.
Yeah. And there was the bit of controversy around the, I think it was called the Thing That Came from Atlantic City Kickstarter that happened earlier this year, where it was a board game that the Kickstarter creator basically took the money and he used it on a lot of things that weren't related to the Kickstarter, and the designer and artist never saw any money from it.
Yeah.
And it ended with, I believe there may have been a legal case involved, but one of the major board game publishers basically took the game, hired the designer and artist, and are now paying them. So I don't know what happened to the actual creator at the moment.
Right.
Probably under a rock right now.
Yeah, and that's the thing about choosing these Kickstarters. There's so many of them that it's really become a different landscape, even in a year or so, than it was when Balladim was up in 2011.
Right, I was right before the big boom, because it was early 2012 when Double Fine earned just a ridiculous amount of money, and everybody and their mother signed up for Kickstarter.
Yeah, and since then, as you just said, just about anyone who knows a programmer as an artist now are putting up Kickstarter projects, and the quality is such a huge difference. We've seen, you know, guys who put up complete prototypes and games that are in alpha into Kickstarter, and then we got people who say, hey, I got an idea that I was just talking to three of my friends about. We need $5,000. Can we have
it? Right. Yeah, I think critical critical reading skills are necessary to be a successful Kickstarter backer. I actually rarely watch the videos because they're either so poorly produced that they prejudice me against a project that may be otherwise worth my attention, or they're so slick and flashy that I become immediately mistrustful. For some reason, if your video is really hyper well produced, I sometimes wonder whether you need my money on Kickstarter or if I should just wait for you to come out with your product and buy it then. And it's not that you shouldn't be using Kickstarter as a promotional platform, because that's absolutely what Kickstarter is. But I usually just read the text and can tell a lot about the project by what they don't tell you, as much as what they do tell you.
Now, here's a question for you. When you're eyeing Kickstarters, do you find yourself gravitating more towards when, like, a big name has a Kickstarter, someone like Roberta Williams or American McGee, although he may not really be a big name, or do you find yourself more, like, looking at, like, the small, you know, like, the relatively unknown people when they do a Kickstarter?
I tend to back relatively unknown people. I figure they need the money more than just the attention. Some of the big names, I know the money is very helpful. I did back the Veronica Mars movie because it was a vote of interest in the movie being made. And yes, there was still a studio involved that ended up paying him money to make the movie as well. But without the Kickstarter groundswell, I don't think it would have happened. But usually I'm supporting a philosophy. I'm looking for something that is, particularly these days, culturally relevant or socially relevant, or a type of game that isn't obsessed with machismo characters and gratuitous amounts of violence.
For me, it's basically if it's from a genre or game that I haven't seen from a long time, but I really want to. So I backed Planetary Annihilation for macro-style real-time strategy. I did Stoneheart for its city builder, dwarf fortress-esque design. And I just did one this month for like an 8-bit like Star Control type game that I cannot remember the name off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see. Most recently, I've backed Everjane, which is the Jane Austen MMO, which had a working prototype during the Kickstarter. I backed Cherbles because it looks adorable, and I'm all in favor of adorable games. I really like the character design in Cherbles. And I backed a project called Stop Telling Women to Smile, which is an installation sort of art project. A woman decided that she started doing anti-street harassment art and posters and wanted to bring it out across the country. So she's been doing posters in Chicago, Baltimore, Boston, San Francisco, Miami, Los Angeles. Anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's like the funny thing about Kickstarter is that it, with all the buzz around the video game industry, it's sometimes hard to remember that there's a lot of other projects on Kickstarter that aren't video game or game industry reliant.
Right.
Yeah, just recently I actually backed a project for a website that just went down. Their parent company decided to lay everyone off. So they put a Kickstarter up, and within like 5 hours they got all their funding, and now they're going way above it. That's really interesting. But that's the first of that kind of project I ever donated to, just because I loved their content so much. But for my Kickstarter kind of trends, I actually like to pick up any project that is related to virtual reality. So there's a game called Lacuna Passage, Mars Exploration.
Yep.
And they use like the map of, you know, of Mars for the most part to kind of create it, and they kind of put a little story to it also. But that's, you know, they're building it from the ground up with the Oculus in mind. Frontiers is another one, which is an exploratory game. It's like a realistic version of Minecraft, but with, again, with the idea of the Oculus Rift in mind. And also kind of like older titles or titles I haven't seen, or game developers that have been, you know, in hiding and came out with awesome projects like Abduction, which is from the Creators of Myst. Mm-hmm. And I think the one that I loved the most, I put the most money into, was the Longest Journey Kickstarter project.
Yep.
And I don't know, those guys are just, and I think this is a really important thing, and I really think that it's a big factor when I'm looking at Kickstarter projects, is the people element. If the person's in the video, if you can actually like feel their honesty, then it compels you more to donate.
Sure.
Yeah, I think as Corvus said, in terms of like production values, one of the things that turns me off is like the video you see like guys who are they're just like very, I guess, douchey could be like the word. You know, they look, they're trying to make themselves look like they're better than everyone else, saying, you know, give me money so I can make my best game idea ever. I was like, yeah, no.
But you also have to do something to stand out, too. Yeah. And even though the text is important, too, I mean, a lot of people look at the video, and everyone always focuses on the video, too. And they add kind of like, and also I think it's the rewards, too. I think that's a big part for some people.
I will probably talk about this later on regarding storytelling. About Chorus, I just want to get your thoughts on what do you think about the Oculus Rift? Because we've had guests on, we've had some say they're loving the idea, others aren't so enthusiastic about it.
Meh. Have you tried it?
Nope, I haven't.
It's okay, don't go, there's so many people that are against the Oculus Rift because of the 90s and their big push for VR then, but a lot of technological advancements have been done since then. And
I have no question that it's a remarkable technology. I have no question that it's gorgeous and wonderful. I do question whether in my personal sort of evolution of playing games, whether wearing a helmet and further isolating me from my world in order to enjoy a game is what I'm really interested in. I hardly ever play games on the PC anymore. And the only reason I own a console is because the opportunity to have Wind Waker HD and sort of a dedicated Wind Waker machine was too great. And so most of my gaming is done on iOS or on my 3DS. So it's handheld. It's sort of, you know, it allows me to play in very short bursts and put it down and hold conversations with people if somebody walks up. So it's just a personal taste issue. It isn't that I think the Oculus Rift is bad or that I'm anti the Oculus Rift. It's just that my gaming tastes and preferences, I don't believe, I'm sort of with Dan Cook on this one of Spry Fox. I don't know that the full immersion games are necessary for creating a great narrative experience.
I just think it would be interesting to see how people will do narrative experiences with the Oculus Rift. Like, how will they deal with allowing the player to look in 360 degrees and stuff like that?
They're going to shoot a bunch of stuff, and then they're going to have you be locked in place for a while actors in your environment rehash the author's idea of what the story should be.
What I've been seeing in trend-wise for games developed for the Oculus Rift is a lot of horror games where there isn't much things to kill, just a lot of creepy exploration or adventure games that, again, it's not really violent. And there is controls that will augment it. I mean, there's right now, I guess the best experience is a racing game because you're sitting down. But there's things like the Omni treadmill, which allows you to walk and run in any place, and the STEM, which is like replicates your hands in a 3D space, which is really cool. So we'll see exactly how that turns out. But I completely understand because we've had many developers come on. We kind of asked them, and a lot of them just said it's not really just not their thing, or they like the experience, but it also makes them have motion sickness. So, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why. But I think, again, until the consumer thing comes out, I think people will still be on the fence with it.
Yeah, I think once we actually see it in the public market and see how the general consumer views it, I think that's going to determine whether or not the Oculus Rift has a future or not.
I just think they need to demo it as much as possible. I think when someone actually tries it and experiences it, then they realize it's more than just those crappy 90s HMDs.
They're also going to need buy-in from the major publishers. I mean, so they're going to need a full roster of software titles that your average consumer will be excited about.
Yeah,
that's the beautiful thing, though, because of Kickstarter, they were able to send out developer kit for the last like year plus. So they've had a lot of people that are in and out of the industry making games for it or modding games that already exist to work with it, which is really cool. So when the consumer version comes out, we'll have a huge library.
And John,
but my point is you're going to need the marketing dollars of EA. I mean, as much as I hate to say this, because I'm very historically anti-EA, and I think Activision is right behind them. And I think Eidos makes some of the worst decisions about how to manage the properties of anybody. All the big publishers, Ubisoft is the only one I allow myself to have the occasional fond feeling for. But I do feel that for a high-dollar entertainment device like the Oculus Rift, you are going to need the extra marketing push of EA and Activision and Eidos and Ubisoft saying, hey, look, we have your franchise games on this platform, on this system. Without that, they're going to struggle.
Well, they did just get some amazing funding. Like last, I think like 6 months ago, they said that they got $16 million But as of like last week, they said that now 75 million of flush cash investment. So I think it's really going to become something. And they're everything's so secretive around them. All they do is build this giant hype train on their subreddit. So I'm hoping for the best, expecting the worst, so that kind of thing.
And I know John Carmack recently left id Software. Now, is he the CIO or the CEO?
CTFO.
CTFO, got it. Okay. One final question about Kickstarter for you, Corus, before we move on.
Mm-hmm.
It's another question that we like to ask all of our guests that come on. As we talked about with Kickstarter blowing up over the last year, thanks to Double Fine and et cetera, there's some people thinking that, I guess they're debating whether or not Kickstarter will remain a viable platform for game development. And this is something that we've discussed a lot. I'm of the opinion that we're at the point where we really need to wait and see what happens to these big successes before we can say definitively yes or no. But for you, Corvus, what do you think? Do you think that Kickstarter will remain viable or not?
Specifically for video games?
Yes.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. I think, so here's the thing. The big studio system has had gatekeepers in between the consumer and what the consumer wants for ages. And it leads to situations like what's happening with the comic book industry right now, where we've learned that Cartoon Network has specifically said, no, we don't want superhero shows for girls, period, because girls don't buy the action figures, and the action figures are where the money is. So we only want... And so we've had these gatekeepers, and they've set up these systems by which they tell us what people want, despite the fact that they're supposed to exist to give us what we're asking for. Yeah. Kickstarter is an end run around that. It's somewhat curated, so we're not just getting everything, but it gives us the option to vote with our dollars. And if something fails or doesn't succeed, it's a lesson learned. I know people, I follow people on Kickstarter who told me not so long ago, well, I'm not going to use Kickstarter anymore because of this or because of that. And yet I see them. They're still drawn back and they still are contributing to Kickstarters. It's really with 3D printing and at home fabrication and with all of these technologies on the rise and with all of the tools that are available for free to make games and to produce things, Kickstarter is going, it's the direction a large portion of business is going to go.
And as a quick aside, I'm still annoyed about that statement about Cartoon Network canceling shows because they didn't want girls buying the action figures. That to
They say girls don't buy the action figures. Girls don't buy the shows. Yeah.
That to me is just that breaks my mind to think about that you wouldn't want an audience of both men and women or boys and girls watching your own show.
Right.
But to me, I think that would pretty much be like the perfect goal because we're seeing a lot of shows these days. Either they're made for kids but have like, you know, winks to older audiences, or they go the route of trying to appeal to both genders. And I think those shows seem to be the ones that are generally succeeding more than not these days.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're trying to play it safe, right? That's like the big problem in the 90s and 80s, focus groups, right? Mm-hmm. We watered down like every product. And I think, at least in recent memory, in games that we've seen recently, I think there was an Insomniac game that came out called...
Fuse.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, right. And it was originally like a Pixar four-player co-op, third-person shooter game that looked really interesting in terms of its not only its art direction, but its humor. And then when the game actually came out, they sucked all the originality out of it, and it became a generic third-person shooter, Go Bravo Team, shoot 'em alien, whatever thing. It just was miserable what actually happened to it. I'm pretty sure that was because of focus groups and, you know, bad feedback and stuff like that, so...
One other question for you, Corus, just sort of along the lines of Kickstarter. What do you think about early access and stuff like Steam's Greenlight program as ways of basically voting with your dollars on a game that's may be anywhere from beta to alpha 1 at the moment?
Well, see, I think that's really interesting, and I'm really pleased to see all of these really sort of experimental games show up in my Steam queue now, thanks to Greenlight. I also think that Greenlight, when dovetailed with Kickstarter, is becoming a really powerful combo. A lot of things are getting onto Steam because they've got a strong showing on Kickstarter. And again, you're letting the consumers vote on the products that they want. And I think that's really telling. One of my very first sort of video game industry experiences was seeing a vice president of EA speak before a group of college students And I asked him about indie developers, and he scoffed at me and laughed and said, you can't just have two people in a garage making a game anymore. That's great if you want to do that, but it's because of us that there is an industry. Without EA, there wouldn't be an industry out there for you to make your games for. Mm-hmm. And there's elements of truth in that, in the way the industry has grown. That is certainly true. Does it need to be true? No. And I think we're seeing more and more, look at the amount of money spent on Kickstarter, on video games, and on Greenlight, and on indie games, and through GOG, and through Steam. I think we're starting to see more and more of a challenge to EA's financial stranglehold on the industry. There are a lot more options out there. Whenever a studio gets shut down by EA, I say that I really look forward to all the awesome indie studios we're going to get. And more often than not, that has proven to be very true. Mm-hmm. You see some really great things coming out of corporate layoffs.
I think it's pretty funny that EA goes, they go by EA now instead of Electronic Arts, because I'm pretty sure the arts has been long gone since for many years.
I don't know if the arts was ever actually there.
And speaking about saying that indies aren't going to do much, there was, of course, the famous line, you know, the PC industry's dying, everything's going to be consoles only. And that has been such a complete reversal, thanks to Steam, and probably thanks to indies, and just the general indie market has grown to such a magnitude over the last, I would say, maybe 4 or 5 years, or maybe even a little less than that.
Right. Yeah, if you just look at the AAA, you know, sure, the PCs was dying. But more and more now, I'm starting to see a resurgence. I run OS X, and I'm seeing a resurgence of AAA games being ported to OS X. It's not, you know, anywhere near parity with what's released on the PC platform, but I get my XCOM and a handful of other games, so I'm happy. Plus all the great indie titles, of course.
Right, yep. I wonder how, is GOG stuff still compatible with Mac games? Well, you know?
A lot of GOG is, it's not every title, but it is many titles.
Well, that's still pretty awesome, because I love GOG. Two platforms I usually use for buying PC titles, or, you know, whatever title like that, is Steam and GOG. Just for one, for the games that are currently coming out, and the games from my nostalgic past.
So moving away from Kickstarter, I want to talk about another thing that you've been working on, Corvus. As you said earlier in the cast, you sort of moved away from the video game industry by and large at the start of this year.
Yes.
And part of that was what you talked about, I think it was on Google+, which was you were going to attempt a low-violence video game challenge.
Yep.
So for the people who don't know what that is, could you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, it's had two stages. The beginning of the year, here, and I actually brought the posts up so I can just read you verbatim here. What the beginning of the year, I was going to play no games that had violent conflict as the core mechanic. Let's see, scrolling back down here. Yes, I will not buy or play any video games where the majority of the gameplay centers on violent conflict. Now, there were some other more industry-aimed rules that were sort of alongside this, but that was the core piece of the violence piece. I also said that I would not buy or play any video games that were played by publicly traded companies. Mm-hmm. So for the first 6 months of the year, I only played indie titles, and I played a lot of mobile titles. and then in phase two, which was about mid-year, I modified it a bit. And this experiment was as much for to see what it did to me as a gamer, mm-hmm. as any sort of commentary on the types of games anybody should be playing. I had a lot of people very upset at me initially when I announced the Low Violence Challenge and yell that violent video games don't cause children to shoot children. And I'm like, that's not, like, what... Where in what I said is that something I'm claiming to be true? Mm-hmm. I'm just much more interested, as a gamer who wants to see a broader spectrum of relationships in games than violent ones, mm-hmm. I want to make this change in my diet. So my revamp changed that rule to be I will not play any games where the majority of gameplay graphically depicts intraspecies violence and or gore. So the gore is a separate thing from intraspecies violence. In other words, no human-on-human killing. That is graphically depicted, and nothing with intense amounts of gore. So I could play Brutal Legend on the low gore setting as a part of this.
Okay.
The new rules, for example. Ironically, I changed the rules so that I could play XCOM, which had been released on OS X. I had actually purchased it through Steam for Windows in 2012, at the end of the year, and not really ever played it because I don't go into boot camp very often. And had subsequently removed my Windows install. It was released on OS X, and I really wanted to play it. And so I, in part, changed the rule so that I could, you know, shoot aliens. But I also bought myself a 3DS. Mm-hmm. I bought the Animal Crossing Limited Edition 3DS, and I found that I never played XCOM. I did nothing but obsessively play Animal Crossing. So I actually, as far as the core gameplay rule, went all the way back to the first half of the year for the majority of my gameplay for the second half of the year, actually.
And I think it's kind of interesting that this is the year that we saw a lot of narrative-based games, or I guess gain some notoriety. We saw Gone Home, Stanley Parable, mm-hmm. even games that would probably be considered violent, like Amnesia, The Machine for Pigs.
Right.
So what are your thoughts that this may sort of be leading into our narrative discussion next, but what are your thoughts on games that are more focused on a narrative or storytelling rather than gameplay or game mechanics?
Whoa, now, hey, now, you're making a dichotomy that doesn't exist. So this kind of gets at the philosophy, the core philosophy of my loving narrative games. Mm-hmm. I am not a huge fan of games that are structured around a linear narrative created by an author or a team of writers that want me to sort of experience their character arc as they saw it. I don't care for that. I'm not against it. I'm not anti it, but I'm also not, like, I don't get wrapped up in those narratives as provided. Those textual, what I call textual narratives. What I do really enjoy is the story that unfolds through gameplay. As I make choices in the game, the way in which my experience of the game changes. So, I've played Link Between Worlds now nearly to completion three times, completed it twice. There, one way in which you can play the game is to kill every enemy you come across on every screen. Now, they respawn. Anyone who plays Zelda games knows that when you leave the screen and you come back, all the same enemies are there again. So you could have a game that is very, very excessively violent with lots of fighting. Mm-hmm. However, there is not really a lot to be gained from killing those enemies. Mm-hmm. They might give you a couple of rupees. They may give you a heart in some of the games if you're running low on health, although there are much easier ways of getting hearts. Cutting grass, for example, which doesn't fight back. So you could actually get really good at avoiding them, learn their routes, learn where they are, and as you're moving about the world, spend all of your time avoiding them. That creates a narrative difference. That creates a different experience of the game, which lets you tell a different story about Link. And the way you're playing Link. And it's those decisions and it's those options within a game that I feel make the most compelling storytelling elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been playing Zelda 2. I'm up almost on my second playthrough at the moment. And I'm just loving the game, just as like going back to that classic era of them basically not dictating this entire story to you and just saying, hey, this is Hyrule. You know, you have these 7 points to go to, but, you know, do what you want. You're right. Not force A, B, C, D, and E kind of deal.
There are two Zelda games that I feel really actively reward exploration. Mm-hmm. And one of them is Wind Waker. And whereas in the core game itself doesn't actually reward exploration, I find the aesthetic beauty of sailing in Wind Waker mm-hmm. to be so compelling that I find that the aesthetics alone encourage and reward exploration. But in Link Between Worlds, they've made that rewarding exploration a core part of the game, something that you have to do in order to progress. And the game world's actually very small and very compact, very densely packed. I don't think I've played a game where the level was so dense since the Mists of Pandaria expansion for World of Warcraft, where that first island, like you're in this area for a while and you suddenly realize that just over this slight hill, the world opens up into this amazing new vista. And it's, but all of Link Between Worlds is that dense. Even the dungeons feel really compressed and dense. And therefore you don't have a lot of wandering around aimlessly, because everywhere you go, you stumble upon something. And I find that a really compelling narrative approach.
Yeah, and I'm still like trying to find like all the secrets as well. My first playthrough, I just basically checked everything off, went through each dungeon, immediately got through the game in like maybe like 4 or 5 hours. Second time through, I'm now taking my time, I'm exploring, and I realized that not only did I miss an entire system of allowing to upgrade items, but yeah, there's several items I know that are out there that I haven't even discovered yet, which I don't want to reveal for spoilers' sake.
Ah, spoilers, schmoilers. So, like, some of the special items you get in dungeons, is that what you're referring to? Some of the gear items?
Yes, but I'm referring to... I know the dash boots are somewhere, but I haven't found them yet. I must have missed them in some very obvious...
Oh, I guess maybe you don't need those for the core...
Yeah, I don't have them. I actually finished the game without them, and I didn't upgrade the Master Sword completely. I only got one upgrade level before taking on the final boss.
Do you upgrade armor?
Yeah, I got the blue and the red.
I was thrilled when I discovered that you can actually update your two most sort of basic non-combat items as well. The lantern and the net, there's a way to upgrade those as well.
I haven't found the net either. And it's funny to me, like, you just said that you have those great items, and I haven't even found those ways yet. And I'm on my second, I'm actually at the point where I could beat the game a second time on the hard mode, and I still haven't found, like, those core upgrades. And I know it's either in some place that I probably completely miss, or maybe there is, like, a secret out there that I haven't gotten around to finding yet.
Right.
Now, going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding your preference towards games that let the player tell a story,
right,
are you a fan of, I guess, sandbox or open world games, stuff like Minecraft or even something like Kerbal Space Program that basically says, here's Space Program, do whatever the hell you want with it?
So I am to a degree. I do find that Minecraft, however, is pretty barren of meaningful interactions. Mm-hmm. So it's great if I want to tell a story about a lone crazy guy who's building an 8-layer dungeon that just happens to follow the layout of Ultima Underworld's Stygian Abyss, which I spent probably about a month getting the first level of Ultima Underworld's Stygian Abyss done out, not in unlimited mode. So I actually had to mine for my resources. And, you know, that's okay, but I would like to see more people experiment with sandbox games that have a social sandbox, where interacting with other sort of AI-driven, sentient within the context of the game world characters in a meaningful fashion. That impacts your gameplay experience in some way, positively or negatively.
I remember there was that MMO, or like free-to-play MMO from a few years ago, it was an Egyptian one, that was all about basically crafting. There was no combat.
A tale of the desert.
There it is.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty interesting. And going back to what you just said about meaningful actions, to me, that's one of the things that I guess annoys me about a lot of the open world games that we see these days, is that basically the core of the experience is doing a linear series of missions. And the rest of the world just feels very sterile, very plain. And I know we talked about this on a previous cast with Chris Garner, but I think the three of us loved Shenmue at the time for just how much detail and how much they actually packed into this relatively small environment to make it feel alive.
Mm-hmm. I've not played those, actually, so I can't comment on those.
I think it's God Home also does something similar to Shenmue, where you can interact with everything, even if it isn't really actual use in gameplay. But it works more for the narrative anyways, because it's about narrative, about your exploration that fills in the narrative, which is really cool. But for both those games,
I think with that, that's a good segue to our final topic for the cast, and that's just talking a little bit about storytelling. Corvus has written many posts on the topics of storytelling in the past. So, to begin with, Corvus, for 2013, what were some examples of great storytelling in video games that you played?
Proteus. Mm-hmm. Proteus. Have you played that?
I have not. It's on my list of things to get to. Have you played it, Ken?
No, but I have seen many videos on it.
So there's a moment in Proteus where something pretty magical happens. And it's not even, I mean, of course there's, so Proteus, for those who don't know, it's a surprisingly lush and gorgeous game for a game with an 8-bit color palette. Really low res graphics for everything. It's a 3D exploration sort of game. You are on an island and you wander around. That's pretty much the sum total of gameplay. If I recall correctly, you can't even jump. So you're just walking around, you do have interactions with things on the island. Things do react to your presence. Mm-hmm. But there's hints that there's other things or that there have been other people. There's standing stones. There's, bits of things that look like ruins that could be interpreted as ruins. But anyway, while interacting with Proteus, and seasons change, something rather remarkable and startling happened. And I thought it was a great moment because it had there was no explanation. There was no one telling me that the gods this or the gods that or the technology existed or anything. It just happened and let me do a full interpretation of what it meant and what the implications of it were on my experience.
Okay. That's also one of my favorite kind of experiences about your own exploration, your own feelings of it, and how can you inject what you see with whatever general event happens. So.
Right.
Well, by the time this cast goes up, hopefully the Steam Winter Sale will be upon us, so maybe that'll be a chance for us to grab it then.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. I very much enjoyed it. I played it quite a bit during my first half of my low violence challenge. And then the other game that I'm gonna call out as being a storytelling game that actually gives us tools to create our own stories. So it's very much a sandbox. Is Animal Crossing New Leaf. There's nothing dictating to you the order in which you should do things. There's nothing dictating to you that you need to become engaged with any of the systems they present. And yet there are a lot of different systems, and they're pretty shallow mechanically. Much of them don't resemble what the vast majority of your audience and probably even one or two thirds of the people on this call would consider gameplay. It's an expressive game or a performative game. It is a game that allows you to assemble the game components, in a way to produce personal expression, both through the way you interact with the villagers, in your town, whether you try to annoy them and make them dislike you, so hopefully they'll leave by hitting them with a fishing net every time you see them, or whether you engage with them in conversation or bring them medicine when they're sick. To the decoration of your house. I actually have four characters in my Animal Crossing village, and each of them has a different decorating scheme. And then in the basement, which they've all got screened off with a variety of appropriate things, they've got sort of their true secret personality that acts as a counterpoint to the main decoration themes of the houses. And I find it oddly satisfying. There's an almost sort of zen sense of ritual and responsibility without any of the nagging guilt that I experienced in the initial games. They did a really good job of smoothing it out. I've got friends who play. There's a Facebook group of people so that we can share resources if we're looking for a hard-to-find furniture item or something. So it's been a very good sort of game for social glue and social connectedness. A coworker of my wife's now has the game, and so she and I have been discussing gameplay and planning a time to get together and visit each other's villages, and that's the sort of narrative experience that's possible without forcing like a linear life and death tale down your throat that I find very satisfying in games.
Now, a few minutes ago when you were talking about Minecraft, you also mentioned that it was also a game based around simple interactions, simple mechanics. And you said that it didn't really, like, get you involved that much. Yep.
There are characters in Minecraft. I think what makes Animal Crossing work for me is that there are interactions with other characters, and I can choose. And they're really shallow. But your different animals that move into your town can have different personalities, and they have different things that they say to you. Sometimes, for example, there's a cranky chicken in my town. He wears a knight's helmet. His name is Knox. He's been in my town since day one and has never asked to move, which I really appreciate. And I was on a tangent for a while where I was sending all of my villagers letters with little gifts attached. And immediately after the mail delivery, which happens at 2 set times every day, I saw Knox bounding. Now, mind you, he's a cranky chicken, usually kind of walks around and glowers and says cranky things, but he's bounding across a field with little notes, and there's a little singing tune when animals are singing, and he's singing, and he's clutching a letter. So there was just this little storytelling moment that I sent Knox something he really liked. I sent Knox something that he really liked as an attachment to the letter, and he got excited about it, and I might not have seen that. Like, it was completely random circumstance that I saw that. Mm-hmm. But there was just that briefest moment of, within the context of the game, I had made Nox's day. Uh-huh. And that is something that, like, Minecraft is missing. You can't make anybody's day in Minecraft.
There's, like, no, like, real sense that the game itself is going on without you kind of deal. Everything is, like, on you to make happen.
Right.
Okay. Right. All right. And on the flip side of this, were there any games you played this year that you felt basically failed in your eyes in terms of good storytelling?
Well, let's see. I'm going to go with, I guess, I'm looking through my Steam list here to see if there's any indie titles I can call out. But, you know, I just recently decided I rejoined Gamefly. I figure I've got this Wind Waker console sitting under my television. I might as well play some other games, and with the low violence challenge being up at the end of the year, I'm going to see how I feel about Assassin's Creed, the Assassin's Creed franchise, now that I've not played violent games for a year, and see if it's changed my taste for that franchise, which I used to really like. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so as a transitional, I got a couple of Lego games. So I was playing Lego City Undercover and Lego Marvel Superheroes, and they're both. They talk now in Lego games. Once upon a time, there was no speaking.
Yeah.
So it was all visual storytelling in the cutscenes. And now they talk. And while they did some clever things, they had some clever lines of dialogue in Lego City Undercover, the writing in the Marvel one is just so dreadful. So tedious and so pedantic. And the level design is abysmal and reveals all of the worst flaws of the Lego game engine, which I know they've been using since day one and just adding stuff to, and so I know it's difficult to correct some of those problems. And I just find myself really put off by them. They used to be these very sort of charming, even though they were giving you a linear narrative story, it was done in a way that allowed for a lot of interpretation, and it was pretty silly. And now they've gotten, I feel, really heavy-handed with the storytelling elements, and they've gotten less delightful with their level design. The level designs feel like tedious explorations in having characters with varying abilities, as opposed to fun environmental challenges that you have to figure out how to overcome.
Yeah, the last Lego game I think I played was one of the Star Wars ones. Wasn't the first one. I think it was one that was based on, I think, one of the trilogies.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about writing, or at least trying to write, that appeals to people, that it really is an art form to write something, especially for kids' games, that doesn't, you know, make you want to tear your hair out and cover your ears. I played the DuckTales Remastered game this year, and this is the remake of the classic NES.
Yes.
And one of the things they did was they got brand new cutscenes, and they have most of the original actors reprising their roles. And the dialogue is horrible. It's, you know, people talking very slowly, saying things that just are, there's just, like, no wit to it at all.
Right.
And there was a time where you couldn't skip the cutscenes. I feel sorry for all the people who had to play the game. You need to listen to these, like, 2 to 3 minutes worth of cutscenes per level.
Right.
Maybe they don't have to throw back to the show, because their dialogue wasn't always the snappiest either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it's interesting how we're seeing that, like, going back to the whole, like, change in, like, the cartoon and animation industry, that we're seeing a lot more cartoons these days that have, like, wit to them. I know people love, like, My Little Pony. I've been watching Gravity Falls. There's, of course, Avatar The Last Airbender, which is probably, like, one of, like, the best animated series in, like, the last decade.
Definitely.
Absolutely. No argument here.
So, it's definitely possible, but I think, as we've said, it's just one of the things that it's really like catching lightning in a bottle sometimes.
Well, with the Lego games too, like with all the really exaggerated animations and stuff, it gives you a better sense of what's going on. And then again, it's better to show than not tell. You know, all this exposition they give you, it's kind of ruins the experience because it's supposed to be. As you said before, it was charming before because it was cute. You know,
right.
But now that you have to hear them talk, and then you also have to listen to bad voice actors or this really just bad delivery.
Right. Well, I will say that the voice act, like the quality, I have no qualms with the quality of the voice actors on either of those games. It's just, I don't need Agent Coulson in my ear telling me the same piece of information about how to interact with a particular environment detail over and over and over. Mm-hmm. I don't need really bad jokey punny barks from each superhero character throughout the level. Like, I don't need that filler space. I don't need the extra hand holding. I don't need
there's nothing like when they have like the character repeat their catchphrase after every like 3-hit combo. Hearing it for like 27 times a level.
You know, I see that in a lot of reviews nowadays, people hating like, you know, repeated lines of dialogue or moves, or just those cutscene moves you have to do within the gameplay itself, because you see it eventually too much and all this charm gets like, lost.
Right. Like, that's one of the things I loved about Wind Waker. The actual dialogue is very minimal, but they did all of these great sort of character mannerisms or noises, and they would play those. Whenever you'd meet a character, you'd get this little sort of grunt or growl or squeal or sort of nonsense word, and that served to give you an idea of what their voice sounded like while you were reading their dialogue. And I thought that was a really excellent way of adding strong, clear audio cues about how to interpret a character without relying on doing a lot of voice acting.
I think that's why Wind Waker is probably one of my favorites. Not only is it extremely expressive in its animation, but they also did a lot of the mannerisms on purpose, like the sound cue you just talked about, make it more universal for anyone to play the game.
Yes.
So I think that's wonderful, and it makes it more timeless than the other games, especially compared to Twilight Princess.
Yes. Agreed.
That's what Miyamoto's, he wanted to make Wind Waker, but he was kind of forced to make Twilight Princess.
Yeah. Yeah, Twilight Princess's character design's a little all over the map.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and just to go back about the voice acting thing.
Yes.
I was playing some old Dreamcast games. I was playing Alone in the Dark for the Dreamcast, and we have come a long way in voice acting since then. So I don't even know where they pull people out of. It's, I think the developers themselves probably do their voices or something. Because
probably the case with some of these games.
It's so bad. I thought they were trying to be bad. Like, all right, let's be as terrible as possible. All right. No. I don't like the delivery. Make it more stale. Less emotion. Perfect. Got it.
Look up some YouTube videos. I'm sure they exist. Crusader No Remorse.
Is that JRPG game?
No, it's a sci-fi action title from Origin. Richard Garriott's.
Oh, interesting.
Company.
I think it's on GOG, actually.
Yeah. I own one of them or both of them. But if you want to just watch the cutscene videos, it's Richard Garriott and his gaming friends all doing the acting in the cutscenes, the video cutscenes, and it's a real treat. Let me just say.
Well, is it just bad, or is it so bad it's good?
I don't want to insult anyone, so I'll let you. I'll let you apply your own value judgment to the quality of the performances and just tell you that regardless of where you come down on it, it's pretty delightful.
It's memorable, right?
Because you memorable.
Still remember it. Exactly.
I am smiling broadly just to remember sitting there with my jaw on the ground the first time I had to sit through those videos.
I still have memories like the old EA games, like Shockwave and like those first FMV style games.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That was some good acting right there.
I really want to go back and play those FMV games. Every time I see it on GOG for sale, I really want to pick them up. But then I see like a Let's Play, I'm like, I don't want to play this. I mean, I mean, what's your experience with those kind of FMV games? What do you think about them, playing those? Have you ever played one of those FMV games, like Phantasmagoria?
No. Oh, no, yeah. No, I avoided all of those.
All right.
I avoided anything that had actual... Well, that's not true. What did I play? There was something I played.
Tetris.
But it was pretty... No, it was a pretty obscure one, I think. But no, I avoided most of those because I knew I couldn't, couldn't bear it.
All right. To wrap things up, just one more question then.
Yep.
As you said a few minutes ago, with the year wrapping up, you're going to sort of go and try games that may have a little bit more violence with them, like the Assassin's Creed. I think we're up to four. Are there any other games... Well, actually, let me rephrase that. Are there any, like, high-violent or extreme-violent games that you're interested in trying now that the year is up? Or are there just, like, none that are on your radar?
Well, the issue being I'm limited by platforms at this point as well. I only own the Wii U and an OS X desktop and an iPad and a 3DS. So I think the only one that part of me is curious about is Dishonored. And I know that I won't actually like it, so I'm not too worried about the fact that it's out of my reach. Something about it, watching the videos and hearing its fan, like hearing the people who really enjoyed it talk about their play experiences tells me that I'm just going to find it frustrating, I think.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think you're going to like the narrative, but you're going to really love the style of it. The dystopian steampunk look to it, and the gameplay is very reminiscent of, like, Thief.
Right.
So, like, in terms of what the strongest thing that I remember from the game is the style and the gameplay. But the story too cliched.
Right. And I can overlook that. But I also think, like, it seems to me its pace is much faster than the Thief games. One of the things I liked about the Thief games is they were so slow. You know, they were just as slow as you wanted to make them, and the slower you were, the more likely it was you weren't going to die horribly and quickly.
I guess you're not entirely looking forward to the new Thief game then by Eidos?
No, I've not even bothered to pay any attention to it at all. I just can't imagine they're going to make a Thief game that I'll like.
Actually, one question of a game I want to get your opinion on. Have you played The Walking Dead?
So, okay, that's one of the games. That and one of the early Amnesia games were actually on my list of can I play this despite the low violence challenge? Mm-hmm. And even though in both games you're not actually perpetuating a lot of violence, we kind of reached the determination, we being myself and the people who were giving me feedback on the site, that because the games themselves were so violent, just like the atmosphere of them were so violent, they kind of went against the concept of the low violence challenge. Mm-hmm. But my wife and I do celebrate Zombie Yule every year, and I do own Walking Dead on iOS, so I think we may actually aircast it to the Apple TV this year and group play it at some point. In between George Romero movies.
Thinking about your background, I think it would be really interesting to see your opinion on the game, because I thought the narrative was extremely compelling.
Right.
Even though there was that illusion of choice, but it was still beautiful. And the next game, that Season 2 just came out.
Right.
I'm not going to spoil anything, but I'm saying you play a character that is very, very rare for any game to actually focus on. So.
Yeah. And, Kors, let me know when you do it, because I'm really interested to see what you think about The Walking Dead.
Yeah. I suspect I'm going to enjoy it. I mean, I like the games. I don't tend to like adventure games very much, but I do like or games that have too much text on top of other mechanics. But I do tend to like very just dialogue-driven experiences where the developer is clearly trying to say something interesting as well as present a good story. And I think you can't really work properly within the zombie context and with a franchise like Walking Dead without trying to say something.
And they definitely do. And you know how they take out a lot of that, but the adventure gamey mechanics that we're all used to or we're all scared of. Because when I go back to play old adventure games, that's the worst thing I'm dreading. Like finding all these stupid pieces and trying to rub them together to make some sort of magical thing open up.
Right. It's really mostly a dialogue experience with some really frantic scrambling around to find your gun because the zombies got you pinned against the car.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And some of the best voice acting too in that series too.
Yeah.
And I will also suggest you should look at The Wolf Among Us, which is also came from Telltale.
I was just going to mention that one as well. I'm very curious about that as well. I'm very happy for them that they seem to have found... They seem to have really hit their stride with Walking Dead. Like, they were doing some really interesting games before. They were really doing good homage to adventure games. They clearly were getting, you know, the reboots of adventure games and the reskins and such of the classics. And that was all well and good, and I was happy for them that they were doing well. But it really feels like with Walking Dead, they've hit upon...
like a niche for them, I think.
The formula that really makes them stand out as being as doing something really interesting and unique. And I'm going to look forward to seeing them applying that to different types of narratives and see how well they adapt it. Like, I would love to see them do a romance novel, or, and when I say romance novel, I mean along the lines of Jane Austen or Emily Bronte, or I'd like to see them do something Regency, or do a Dickens tale, do something that isn't necessarily modern or edgy in the way that Walking Dead and Wolf Among Us are, and see how adaptable the system they've come up with is to creating different narrative experiences.
They announced two games recently that they're also going to work on, a Game of Thrones and Borderlands. So we'll see exactly how that plays out with their system. But I just wanted to also say that I think Telltale also kind of revived the adventure game genre, and at least it people's interest in it too, so I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Of course, one last question that I just thought of, sort of like as a final summation of your thoughts on storytelling.
Okay.
Now, we've talked about games that have basically open-ended, or games that let you control the storytelling. Are you, I'm not sure if this is an easy question or not, but do you prefer games where the character is predefined, you know, they have their own background, their own, I guess, personality to the story? Or do you like games where, while there may be somewhat of a linear story, there may be like a general plot, but the character has like no personality? It's basically they're trying to put you as the cipher to it.
It depends. I mean, both can be effective if used well. If I'm going to be playing a character with a lot of personality, I want it to be a character in whose shoes I'm not familiar.
Okay.
In other words, I don't want it to be yet another white guy, right? Like, with just a boring sort of traditional story and the hero's journey story arc that we're all so familiar with and I'm really sick of. I want it to be a character I can empathize with, and I want it to be a character who stretches my understanding of what it means to be human. So like I said, I think they both can be effective tools. And obviously in Animal Crossing, there's no backstory and I'm really enjoying it. But I also like Beyond Good and Evil. I really enjoyed having a clear character with her own emotional responses to the events and activities within that game.
And as you just said with Beyond Good and Evil, that's a good example of a game where they put you in the shoes of a character that you're probably not too familiar with. So it is interesting to see how this character responds as opposed to having just yourself in that experience. All right. With that said, Horace, do you have any final thoughts or anything you want to wrap up with?
Nope, I'm good.
So, with all that said, we're going to wrap things up for this edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Corvus, it was great talking to you this week, and definitely don't be a stranger. I'd love to have you back on again.
Thanks, it was fun.
And I look forward to your announcements in the new year and what you're planning on doing and getting more, I guess, back into your communities, back into gaming, in a sense.
Right. Yeah, it'll be fun.
And Kent, it was great having you on as well.
No problem.
With that, as always, if you are interested in contributing to Game Wisdom, either via a guest post or being a future guest on the podcast, feel free to send me an email. You can find all the information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. That will take you to the guidelines for writing, as well as a direct link to my email. So, with that said, thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.
Have a good night.
Goodbye.